Welcome to another episode of the Religious Studies Project. I'm Christopher Cutter, and I'm David Robertson. We are here again at the White Horse, and we're drinking West Lager, which I believe is a German-style lager, brewed in Glasgow.
Yes, indeed. Lager's not our normal... well, it's really my normal tipple. It's not my normal RSP tipple, but...
And we learned something while we were up at the bar, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. There's a new pope, a new papa.
And this is old news probably by the time this goes out, but it's exciting right now.
Yeah, a Brazilian, I think 76-year-old, they said, so young in comparison to Benedict. So we'll look forward with interest to the probably. The critical analysis that will come out of the religious studies community in the coming weeks on the new Pope Francis the First.
Indeed. This week, however, we're featuring an interview on publishing, on academic publishing specifically.
Yeah, it's a roundtable discussion recorded in Sydney, chaired by Zoe Alderton, who wrote a piece for the Religious Studies Project on Anzac Day, and featuring one of our past interviewees, Carol Cusack, one of our future interviewees,
Alex Norman, and one of our past respondents, George Ioannidis.
Yes, indeed.
And, big Religious Studies Project family get-together, really.
Exactly. And, if you've never published academically, if you have published academically, or if you've been involved in some other kind of publishing or thinking of it, you should get something from this. So even if you're not remotely interested in religious studies, this week, this is a really broad podcast for you. So, although you should be listening every week, obviously.
Yes, obviously.
Without further ado, here we are. Pass you over to Zoe.
I'm Zoe Alderton, and I am the new reporter for Religious Studies Project in Australia. And tonight we're doing our roundtable discussion on academic publishing and editing.
Hi, I'm George Ioannidis. I'm a PhD candidate in the Department of Studies in Religion at the University of Sydney. Completed my honours year last year. Yeah.
My name's Sarah Baustra. I recently finished honours and I'm just about to apply for a PhD at Sydney University.
I'm Simon Theobald. I'm in my second year of a PhD candidature at the University of Sydney in the Department of Studies and Religion on the contemporary manifestations of food taboos in urban Sydney, and I have some small publishing experience.
I'm Dr. Alex Norman, Honorary Research Associate in the Department of Studies in Religion, like everyone else here. And I'm the tourism guy. If David is the conspiracy guy, I'm the tourism guy.
I'm Carol Cusack. I'm the Chair of Department of Studies in Religion at the University of Sydney. And it's my very great pleasure to be sitting amongst such wonderful junior colleagues and discussing such an interesting and important topic for academic careers as publishing.
All right, well, thank you everybody for your introductions. To contextualise who I am, I submitted my PhD a month ago, and it was about the Christian symbology in Colin McCann's artwork and how that has been received by his audience. So today we are speaking about the publishing / editing process. And I want to get us going with a question about journal editing. So for those of you who have been special editors, particularly you, George, who's had a very recent experience of this, do you want to take us through what that process is? How are you solicited to do this? What did the job involve?
Sure. At the beginning of this year, I was special guest editor with Dr. Christopher Hartney of our department of an issue of the Journal for the Sydney Society of Literature and Aesthetics. And currently, with another colleague in this department, I am special co-editor of a postgraduate-themed issue for the Journal for the Academic Study of Religion, which is currently known as the Australian Religious Studies Review. Yeah, the process involved.
Well, do you want to tell us what the themes are first, just to contextualise?
Absolutely. The literature and aesthetics theme was the... this feels like so long ago.
Limits of representation.
Limits of representation, that's right, which came out of a conference. That was also given at Sydney University last year. And the current issue that I'm special editing is themed religion and post-humanism. Yeah. should be good.
It will be.
Yeah.
So what kind of process goes into being special editor? What are your responsibilities with that?
I think best probably to discuss my current role.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you start from scratch, utterly and completely. You're given this responsibility by the particular journal that you're involved in. The head, chief, main editors. With the current one that I'm co-editing on religion and post-humanism, that was a theme that me and my co-editor and I came up with after, an extensive deliberation, a lot of brainstorming, came up with this theme and drafted a call for papers, which had to be approved by the main editors journal.
Did they invite you to special edit the journal and then you guys came up with a theme?
Yeah, it was an invitation. Mm-hmm. Very fortunate to be given that opportunity.
So you and Venetia Robertson is...
Yes, Venetia Robertson, also of our department.
So you guys kind of just brainstormed what you're interested in and...
Met up for a coffee and just banked out some ideas.
Cool.
See what we came up with. And
the most important thing about that, of course, is that that's a totally different model to the special editing that you did for literature and aesthetics. Yes. And actually, Zoe, of course, you've been a special editor for literature and aesthetics as well. Mm. And that's because those gigs grew out of conferences. So the articles were already there. Mm. You just had to deal with the people who'd been part of the conference and perhaps, expand a little bit. When you put out a call for papers like that, which is just totally cold, I think you're going to tell us that the experience was kind of disappointing.
Extremely. You just never know what you're going to get.
And you also don't have a base of people. When I was special editing on a theosophy edition, as Carol says, it was off the back of a conference. We had a lot of participants in that conference who were very enthusiastic, and we were also quite well connected to other people who were invested in theosophy in some way. Mm-hmm. So it was very easy for us off the back of the conference, plus with those personal contacts. But for you, putting it out there, a different world.
Yeah, putting it out there. I mean, it was posted on the Religious Studies Project.
Yes.
And I thank the David and Chris and co who put it up there for us. It was posted on a variety of forums. Cast a wide net and just see what we got, what we came up with. A lot of very disappointing submissions. I don't know if that was just us or if that is a common experience for those that, put out a call for papers from scratch.
Well, Alex and Carol are both editors of their own journals. What do you two think about this? What's the process like when the journal is yours?
I think it's equally bad, but I will talk. I will talk briefly about being a special editor of Australian Religion Studies Review, the journal that's being renamed next year as the Journal for the Academic Study of Religion. Alex was with me with this issue, though he wasn't co-editing. We did an issue on religion and celebrity, and I had the idea. I thought it was a great idea. I told the then editor, Roxanne Marcotte, and she said that's a great idea, and we did exactly what you did. I wrote up a little blurb, kind of abstract for what I wanted the issue to cover, put it out on all sorts of fora, and without doubt, I got proposals that were utterly not able to be entertained at all. And in the end, I was just about to despair. I was about to give up. And I was talking to Alex and he said, oh, I've got a paper I could give. And then I was thinking, yeah, but we're both Sydney and we want some people from somewhere else. Mm. And I was so fortunate. A Netherlandish academic anthropologist, Marlene de Witte, whom I don't know in the meat world, but I've had correspondence with, emailed and said, you know, I think this could be really useful. It's not just I've got an idea, but I've also got two colleagues who've got ideas. And I then pitched it to Roxanne, the editor, as we'll do it as a special issue, collaborative Netherlands-Australia thing. And we ended up getting three Australian papers and three Netherlandish papers, which Marlene got for me. I wouldn't have had any chance for them. And it turned out, I think it's a beautiful special issue with really, really good work in it.
Thanks to your networking.
But we turned down, well, I turned down, and I guess Roxanne Marcot as chief editor was involved as well. I turned down maybe 20 proposals that were sent to me that were just absolutely rubbish.
Did you turn them down because of they didn't address specifically what you thought to be the kind of the canopy of what was required at the special issue, or did you turn them down because they quality issues? What was the reason for the decision not to include them?
So, I mean, I think that's a really good question because it brings us to one of the things that's going to be a big theme for this discussion, which is referee feedback and the idea of quality control, because publishing quality control is really important. Quite a few of the people who wrote to me, I think possibly George might be in the same position, he and Venetia, because they're working on the post-human. It's one of those things that it's a little bit trendy and it's a little bit emergent, and it's not like there's a big, you know, kind of body of scholars who've done amazing things in religious studies in this area. Celebrity was a bit the same. I'd written one piece on it, but a lot of people wrote, and what they were writing was essentially stuff that was amateurish and not academically rigorous. It lacked a kind of methodological grounding. There were often some really good ideas or even examples of celebrities who would have been fun to explore, but they were usually what I just normally call undercooked. A few of them were just barking mad and, you know, you wouldn't want to have anything to do with them. But that wasn't a real problem.
You always get that when you're an editor. You get submissions that are just barking mad. Yes. But part of this is that when you do a call for papers, a lot of people do have good ideas, but they just don't develop them enough. They just haven't had the time to develop them. And that's where the kind of network of people that you know comes into it. But also I think with you and Venetia, George, maybe part of the issue is that it's a, you know, because it's a postgrad issue, part of what you're dealing with is what in part this podcast is about is helping postgrads come to grips with the fact that publishing isn't that big a deal. You know, it's something that you can do and you should do and you should just participate in. And I wonder about the level of shyness, maybe.
Absolutely.
I was just going to say, I've only sort of just completed honours, but I participated in a couple of conferences, and one of them was Alex's Philosophies of Travel conference, which normally I would have felt a little bit shy sort of stepping up and presenting something and even thinking about getting it published. But because the call for papers was so, it made the topic seem really accessible. The call for papers was a broad topic, but quite popular. You could interpret the topic in a number of different ways, and you're given examples of different ways you could approach philosophies of travel. So, I found that to be one aspect of why I got involved with it, but also just because people encouraged me and sort of said, you know, like, what's the worst that can happen? Like, you know, you're not going to be in it or something. But I think even preparing to speak at conferences or preparing articles to be published gets them to a much higher standard than they would have been if you never tried. So it's very important to do that sort of thing.
Well, you mentioned there the importance of peer support. So we've had a discussion about how academic networking can help. But do you agree that the support and the feedback of your peers in the department has also assisted in your publications?
Definitely. And I really think that networking shouldn't be considered to be just impressing people that are, you know, that you've never met before. It's all about building relationships with the people that are at the same level as you and supporting each other and giving each other advice.
Mm.
So. Part of networking, I kind of hate the word networking.
Mm. It is a bit of a corporate buzzword, isn't it?
I feel like I should be in the 1980s when I say that.
You should.
Yeah. But part of it is just kind of saying, hi, I'm here. You know, I'm interested in the subject and I want to be a participant and I'd love to do whatever it is that I can do. If it's write an article, it's write an article. If it's review a book, it's review a book. If it's, you know, do some grunt work, copy editing stuff, then it's copy editing.
Put yourself on the line. Make yourself available.
Mm.
That's the main thing as a starting point. And then who knows the many opportunities that can come your way.
Yeah. But they're only going to come your way if you show a sense of engagement with other people and if you give people the idea that you're really going to put the work into it. Because all these projects we have been discussing are really, really labour intense. And you really do have to show a certain amount of commitment and devotion to them, as George is looking a little bit painted right
now. We don't want to discourage those that would like to submit abstracts for certain special issues.
No, submitting abstracts is an enjoyable experience, and it's a good place. It's a good place to start. And we do appreciate the majority of scholarship very much.
Mm.
It's very interesting to see how other people take particular ideas, such as the philosophy of travel conference, which, as Sarah said, had a very broad theme, and it was amazing the kind of people, Alex, that you had gotten involved in that, who all took it in their own way and in their own direction.
Mm.
So when you're thinking about the publications that come after that, particularly the special edition journal that's just come out, how are you binding those disparate ideas together? Or well, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, no. Part of the process of putting an academic volume together, be it an edited volume or a journal issue, is in a sense stepping into the dark and calling for submissions, and you get them, and suddenly you get a picture of the field maybe that you hadn't seen before. As in, people will come to you with unusual ideas. Or submit papers that address the field in radically new ways that you couldn't possibly have thought of on your own. And in terms of tying those together, it's I hate to say this because it sounds really unscientific, but just having that little thread that goes through, and for my special issue of the journal, it's travel. Just that thread is enough to hold everything together.
Yeah.
As the editor, and that's where the issue of writing introductions comes in, especially important, your job is to make the articles or the chapters speak to each other a little bit, but also then to use the introduction to weave them together in some sense. But when you call people together even if it's just an area, they end up speaking more or less towards similar kinds of ideas. So like in the travel issue of Literature and Aesthetics, we've got things as wide as people's emotions when they travel, the use of the motif of travel by new religious movements. Carol, with her colleague Jason Pryor, wrote a great article on what would you call it? Visiting the ruins of a city in the city that the person lives in. As a travel experience that has to do with identity. Most tourism studies scholars would never think of travel within the city that they live in as travel, but everyone who read that article thought, wow, that really challenges the paradigm.
And I think is evidence why you shouldn't be afraid.
Yeah.
If people who have these unorthodox ideas are too nervous to put them out there, too nervous to give it a shot, they're not going to find out that, you know, we as editors are probably more accepting and more embracive than they may think based on the call for papers.
Yeah. And that's a brilliant point for Simon, you to tell us about the chapter that you put into an edited volume a while back.
Yes, well, I mean, the 2 points, I submitted a chapter to what is now called the Ashgate Research Companion to Contemporary Religion and Sexuality, and It speaks kind of to two things. Firstly, is the importance of mulling over ideas with colleagues, which is certainly it must have been a late night dinner session and a discussion over a particularly unusual website that spawned the initial inkling, and the idea sat in my head for a long time, and I was always looking for somewhere to put the idea, and I thought, well, that's just something that'll never get published. It's too left of field. It'll rest eternally in my mind. And thankfully, a friend of mine who's also in the department one day threw me an email which said simply, "Is this somewhere for your idea?" And it was a link to the call for papers, which was looking for two chapters to contribute to this what had otherwise been completed book. And I
let me just interfere for 1 minute there. That also shows the importance of just sticking your neck out, because that project was basically finished. And what happened was that Stephen Hunt and his co-editor needed two people because two authors failed to deliver to them. So just get it, keep
which
it in all, mind,
which
guys.
Which always happens. As an
Simon
editor.
Had really limited time to put together the chapter. He had to plug a hole, but it went well.
It went well. I wrote an abstract and sent it off, and they said, "Look, this sounds interesting. Could you write the paper?" And I wrote the paper, and then sent it off, not realistically expecting them to say, "Yes, we'll take it." I thought, you know, it's unusual. I'm only in my very first year of a PhD. I've never really published anything properly like this before. And then lo and behold, they said, "Yes, we'd love to have it. It'll go into the book." And the editing process from there was actually surprised me, because it was both incredibly slow and also less. I had assumed there would be lots of sort of saying, you know, "This bit's unacceptable, rephrase this," or that kind of stuff. But I found that overwhelmingly there were sort of cosmetic changes that other people have, you know, as is always the way, always get someone else to look over your work, but other people have good eyes for where you've missed a footnote or just incorrectly referenced something or things like that. And it took them, I've submitted that nearly 18 months ago, and the book is due to be published this December, a year behind schedule, but published nevertheless. It has been, what's been really useful is that it's been a kind of a confidence booster and a stepping stone onto other areas that I feel I could publish in. I mean, certainly sexuality is not one of those things that I'd thought myself as being particularly knowledgeable or well-versed in, certainly not to publish, but I think it showed to me that if you've got a good idea and you can string it out to the required word limit, it's definitely worth putting your neck on the line and trying to get it out there, because even if it's not accepted, chances are you'll get the kind of really valuable feedback, which I think the whole scholarly process is really all about. It's about putting ideas out there and having them critiqued. That would be the kind of...
But you also need to keep in mind, Simon's being very modest here and presenting himself as not an expert in this kind of area, but when he was writing his honors thesis, he was working on the field of online and technological religion, and one of his case studies was the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community. And of course, the article, the chapter that you're speaking about, you so far have avoided telling everybody what it's about, but given them the teaser,
that's what it's about, Simon.
He's going to have to. But it combines ultra-Orthodoxy, technology, and sexuality, which you say is the new component, but the other two bits you were very familiar with.
Yes, I was. It was an unusual combination, and I think in some ways it was probably was almost my green light to go to get into the book, because the website that kind of, I mean, I've always found ultra-Orthodox Judaism quite interesting. I find those communities who are so technology adverse, that kind of sneaky use of technology is always quite interesting. But that the image of Tefillin Date, which was the website that spurred the article.
You're going to have to tell them what a Tefillin Date is.
Tefillin Date is a... hopefully some of you will be familiar with the idea of phylacteries, which are the ritual items that very religious Jews strap to their heads and strap to their arms in order to fulfill the mitzvot of keeping the commandments on your head and on your heart. A tefillin date is when a man takes his tefillin to the young woman who he is sleeping with so he can perform the mitzvah of filling the tefillin. Of putting on the tefillin in the morning. So that kind of that very grey world of use of ritual items in a kind of
Illicit sexual context.
The illicit sexual context. And there was a lot of and part of the joy of writing the paper actually was going to websites like Frum Porn, where I got to look at
From porn,
ultra-Orthodox women, otherwise completely naked, except with a wearing a scheitel on their shaved head, that kind of interesting world. You know, I saw many penises with phylacteries attached to them. It was certainly, but that kind of writing it was, because you know, George was talking previously about writing something from scratch, and for me it was writing from something from scratch, even though I had done a lot of the kind of basic work before. It's if someone puts out a call to papers and you feel like you have an idea that might fit the bill, even if you haven't written it already, it's always a great opportunity to say, well, I will write that 6,000 word, that 10,000 word, whatever it is, to write that article. Because, I mean, as people said to me when I was writing, look, even if it's not accepted here, what you've got is a journal article in the waiting. And you can send it out to other people, you can get other people to read it, and that kind of process of editing, of reflection, is so helpful.
So far we've talked about kindly feedback. What about people's experiences of refereeing and rejection even, perhaps, that that are a lot tougher?
From the author's point of view?
Well, I was thinking, Alex...
Or from the editor's point of view.
You've got a story.
Yeah. I guess, listening to Simon, then, one of the things that we, in the Department of Studies in Religion at the University of Sydney, have championed for a long time is the academic process, which is, have an idea, as Simon says, write about it, and then give it to your peers and get feedback on it. That's essentially what the academic process is. And at the end of it, the idea is that you get published and that the feedback you receive is from anonymous peers for the journal or whatever. We also would encourage people to do that amongst their colleagues as well. And everyone, I think, in this room has read somebody else's article or idea. Mm-hmm. And so you should really, you know, as a budding academic, I guess you should get into the habit of giving your work to your friends, to your peers. But in terms of being an author and getting feedback, yeah, that's sometimes it can be pretty awful. I remember the first thing I sent off was an honours essay I wrote on pilgrimage to sacred mountains in China. And it came back shredded, you know, and my heart as well. But sometimes the process is interesting sometimes because you do get that really useful feedback. You know, the stuff that makes you think, you're right, I absolutely missed that idea in this article and it should be in there. But sometimes you get feedback from referees... and you get rejected from the journal outright or the book or whatever, and what you have to do then is just pick yourself up and send it off somewhere else. And the tale that Carol was alluding to with me is exactly that. I wrote an article and I sent it to a journal and it was rejected outright. I think it went to 3 or 4 referees and all of them rejected it. And I then sent it off to a much higher ranked journal and it got accepted outright and with minor changes.
And there's a secret story there, which I think is worth perhaps commenting. It's a cautionary tale.
Yeah, well, a cautionary tale. And that is that when you submit your work like this, you give over work in progress, essentially, to other people. And in this particular case, it seems like perhaps some of the work that I had done ended up in the work of others, shall we say, unattributed.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's part of the danger of...
Well, that's the real horror story, isn't it? Mm.
Mm.
And it's actually really important for people to understand that what we are saying is exactly what we are saying. The referees of that paper of Alex's were in collusion. They had an interest in the topic area. They didn't want it published in the journal that they were being asked to referee for. What they didn't think was that he would pick himself up, dust himself off, and send it somewhere even better where it would be accepted and it would ultimately appear. They thought that they could shred the work of a very junior scholar. You hadn't even graduated at the time
it in. When I submitted it, I think I hadn't even submitted my thesis.
I think you were very close to the end of the thesis, but what they expected was that he would lay down and die and they would steal his ideas and publish them elsewhere.
Which is very problematic, and it also shows that there's no point in giving up, because had you given up, you would have had your ideas stolen and no subsequent publication. But, Carol, you're a very well-respected academic, but I believe you've had some quite vitriolic reviews given to your work as well.
Yes.
Yeah. I've got some particular ones in mind. I don't know if they're decent enough to share.
Well, yes, the worst case was an article I wrote with my friend Justine Dijons, who is also
very well-respected,
who works at Griffith University in... basically tourism and hotel management. She's a tourism and leisure studies academic. And we wrote an article about September 11 that made a lot of people very, very angry. It was ultimately published in 2003, 2 years after the attacks on the Twin Towers. We did 4 rewrites on it. And the main problem was that we said things that people didn't like. They were actually true, and we had evidence for them. But things like the fact that Scientology volunteer ministers were allowed to work at Ground Zero, and we didn't say that Scientology people were evil and bad and that this shouldn't have happened. We got some referee feedback on that, sort of saying, it is obvious the authors are both Scientologists. They're in the pay of the Church of Scientology. Well, come on, Justine and I are not Scientologists. But the other thing was that
That's so crazy.
We also included channeled New Age responses to September 11 from the Earthlink mission. And people just thought this was ridiculous. You know, everyone was supposed to treat September 11 like it was some kind of extraordinary event that nobody could think about out of the box. We weren't being irreverent in any sense, but we were not concentrating on Christian, Jewish or Islamic responses to that disastrous event.
Mm.
And so the idea that we wanted to say that New Agers and secular people and Scientologists had opinions about what had happened in New York. And were there on the ground. Offended people like you would not believe. And that article grew from being about 5,000 words to being 9.5 in 4 rewrites, because we kept being asked more for why do you think this is okay and how do you think that works, and you know, because you know, we just keep writing back mildly saying, you know, neither the author is a Scientologist. There is evidence for this. We have publications, and there's a letter from the mayor of New York that says the Scientologists were allowed to work on the site. You know, this is not fraudulent. And we just kind of went over and over and over again until finally it was accepted and published.
So it was accepted in that particular publication?
Yeah, it was that particular issue of the journal, that it just took 4 knockbacks and comebacks and sets of emendations.
Because I think, like, what everybody is saying is that, you know, whoever's reading your article, obviously, they may have personal things coming into it, like their own area of expertise and what they like, dislike, and then there's the theme of the journal or publication. But in some cases you can really wrestle with these readers and still get your piece published, but in other cases it's better to find a different audience that is more receptive to your ideas. Mm. And I think especially with your post-human theme, like, to me that seems like certain people would automatically understand what that is and have ideas in their head and want to be involved in it, whereas people who are not familiar with that discourse might not be the right people for the journal, if you know what I mean. So it's sort of finding a good match between what you're writing, the type of ideas you have, and where it's being published and what, you know, their objectives are.
That's really important, because that brings up the question which we were tossing around before we started recording about, just say you've got an idea and you're not responding to a call for papers and you've just written something and it's got your peer feedback and you're thinking, now where do I submit it? How do you make your decision about doing that?
It can be very hard, which is where good contacts come into play. And again, the reason why it is good to get to know other academics in your field, the kind of publications they run and the kind of projects they might be interested in the future. It's also good to participate in conferences, not just to get into conference proceedings, but to understand what kind of journals there are out there. Often a conference will be explicitly affiliated with the organization's journal, for example. My most recent experience with that was speaking at NZASR last year, in which I was able to meet the Religious Studies Department from Otago University. And out of Otago University, they publish Religere, which is a new journal they've started about religion and reception studies, which was also the theme of the conference. Now, they never actually did a conference proceedings, but I was lucky enough to have Eric Repoon, who is one of the editors for the journal, in my session during the conference. And he very kindly asked me to submit afterwards because he had liked my research and thought that it was appropriate for his journal. Now, the material that I had put into that conference, I didn't really expect to go anywhere. It was part of my thesis. It was part of me batting out some ideas that I was wrestling with in one of my chapters. But it was a very interesting process then to turn it into a formal paper, to go from here are some ideas that pertain to, you know, a 100,000-word thesis down to I must now think of one particular thread that I'm carrying through. I must get this down to 6,000 words. But again, it was a great opportunity. And if I hadn't been at that conference, if I hadn't spoken to people like Eric and to Will Sweetman, who also runs the publication, I wouldn't have had that chance. So it is good to know what your colleagues, particularly in the broader international sense, are up to. And that can really help to guide you in that way.
And also, just if people are wanting to submit to a journal, always read a few of the articles first.
Yes, to get the vibe.
And, yeah, it sounds obvious, but I'm sure that we've all heard of examples of where that clearly hasn't happened.
And there are other ways, like in terms of making the process easier for you as an author in trying to get in somewhere. I guess I'm saying this as an editor of a journal and some books. What the editor asks of you in terms of style or language usage, do that. Don't send an article. if the referencing style is Harvard, send it in the Harvard style. You know,
you think it's obvious, but it doesn't seem to sink in.
Yeah, it doesn't, does it?
Mm. No. Well, which gets us on to the uncomfortable topic of the other side of rejections. So we've discussed already what it's like to put yourself out there and to be rejected, how to move on from that. But I think another interesting side of that is, you know, what is it to be the person who is doing the rejection? How do we handle that in a tactful way? And how do we make sure that it's fair, that it's not our personal prejudices that are getting in the way? Because it's not a very nice thing to do. It doesn't feel nice to send somebody a rejection email especially when they've really quite seriously missed the mark. It could be very difficult to negotiate that kind of communication. And George, I believe you've even brought with you a rather tactful email that you've had to phrase for your current issue. Would you like to take us through the kind of content of that, how you approach the issue of rejecting somebody?
Okay.
How did you break somebody's heart?
How did you destroy their world?
Look, it's not, you know, it wasn't just me. I am very thankful to have a co-editor to do all this work together with.
And there's also the peer review process as well.
Absolutely.
Off the back of which rejections really... It's much easier to reject somebody once you've had that peer review process and are able to say, you know, it's not just me, there are actually some very serious flaws, and here are some of the things that the reviewers have brought up, which also gives them a solid basis of work if they do want to change it and update it, to give them that constructive criticism to improve.
Absolutely. And because this special issue is postgraduate themed, we crafted rejection emails that I guess are not the same as one would usually encounter. You know, we had to be very, not so much tiptoe and around it, and kind of write a very, you know, cutesy kind of there kind of email. No, it was more like, you of course thank them for submitting, you thank them for the effort involved in creating an abstract or a paper, putting themselves out there and sending it off. That thanks, that acknowledgement needs to be given. You know, let them know that, you know, they are part of a very large pool of other submissions as well, and also of rejections. To say that we have received such a large number of abstracts or papers, and very few were accepted. I mean, a special journal issue has such limited spaces that you accept a minimal percentage of the submissions that you do receive, and that really needs to be told. You have to say, you know, we thank you. We have received such a large number of abstracts, but unfortunately, you were not successful, as many others weren't either. The special touch that we did, I guess, was suggest that they submit to a journal issue of the journal that we're involved with. That, you know, it might not have spoken to the theme that we were putting out there, the kind of work that we're looking for. But what is to stop someone submitting it to a journal issue of the same journal?
Well, often to reject somebody is not to say that their work is without absolutely any value. Not. It's often saying, we have a particular purpose here, a particular theme, you do not meet it.
Limited spaces, unfortunately. Exactly right. And why not submit it to a general issue?
So just because an editor is knocking you back doesn't mean that all hope is lost. It doesn't mean the project needs to be abandoned. It can be worked on, and it can be submitted somewhere more appropriate.
Absolutely. And we made sure in our emails to make that known, to give that suggestion. Because all postgraduates, all of us, we need that kind of encouragement. We need to hear that. I mean, rejection is inevitable. It's a part of the academic process. We are all going to go through it at some point. And, you know, the fact that we are postgraduates editing a special journal, receiving abstracts from other postgraduates, we know exactly what it is to put yourself out there and to have those feelings. And, we just really try to...
You have to be tactful in these processes.
It wasn't pleasant.
Yeah.
Of course not. It was not pleasant. It's all part of the job.
Well, the other thing that happens is we accept papers that then need special additional work, particularly in some of the publications we've done with people who have English as a second language. And Sarah, you recently have done some work doing some touch-ups on that. Can you explain to us the process?
Yes, I sort of assisted George, who was assisting Alex on the last issue of of LNA.
Don't forget, you've also done editing for Alternative Spirituality and Religion Review.
Yes.
French into English translation.
True, but that was after. This was my first foray into ESL.
The first time is the hardest in ESL world.
And it was sort of, I didn't have any formal editing experience, but I mean, it was just a matter of very carefully reading through the work and kind of keeping notes on the side of the page, just how certain terms were used. Because initially you may think that a sentence doesn't read correctly, but you may misunderstand exactly what they're trying to say with it. And mostly, even though it can be a bit jarring to read sentences that sound like they're not that well constructed, often the argument that is within the paper is sound and well researched and deserves to be published. So it's really just a matter of kind of understanding the way the person writes, the type of terminology they're using, and just tweaking it here and there to make it appropriate for the journal that's being published in, because for an article to be understood is very important. but it's similar to fixing up a very sloppy referencing style or something like that. It's all about comprehension, being able to, you know, have the reader understand exactly what's there rather than having to, you know, think through this opaque mess of you know, either language problems or poor referencing. So
I would like to touch on that briefly, because I think it's actually, I mean, this might be because I am the son of an editor by profession, or just because I'm a natural pedant. But I think there in academia, sometimes there is a tendency, and I know from essays of students I read, where we feel as though we have to write in a certain kind of way, but the reality is clear writing in academic work, as much in journalism or anything like that, as if you get your point across clearly, well written, cogently, that is the best you can possibly hope for. You don't need to write florid prose or something that kind of, it doesn't have to sound, in inverted commas, academic. Using big fancy words, that kind of thing. As long as the message is clear, that in itself, yeah. Some of the best essays I've ever read have just been quite straightforward in their writing style.
I think so. I think it's not about showing off. It's about being clear and coherent and getting your point across, which is essentially what publication is all about. It's about you coming up with a particular argument. It's about you being able to shape that into an appropriate paper that meets the specifications of an appropriate journal or book, and the ability to really put your neck out there to risk the peer review process and to be heard. So these are the kind of the core issues for me as someone who has submitted work and also somebody who's done a lot of editing work. Does anyone else have any other final remarks about their experiences, either as an academic who is putting their work out there or as somebody who is receiving and collating the work of others?
Well, why don't we go around the circle again?
Sure. Yeah,
2 minutes.
George, what do you think?
What do I think as a final kind of send-off?
History of the universe.
Cool. The main thing I've learned is to just put yourself out there. That is the main message in regards to making a name. It is all about making a name for yourself, getting your name out there to see what kind of opportunities in academia can come your way. It's just about not having any fear. Just, you think you have an idea, run with it, see what happens. Talk to your colleagues, your peers, get it out there. Sarah?
One thing that we haven't quite touched on yet that I think is very important about participating in conferences and, you know, going through the whole peer review process is that when you have an area of research, PhD, whatever it may be, it's very easy to get, like, tunnel vision with your topic and you sort of forget to think about the broader academic community. And I think that submitting things to, like Simon was saying, you know, he had two aspects that he was familiar with, but the sexuality part of it was not, you know, part of his previous writing. So that sort of pushed him out of his comfort zone. And I think that it's very important to kind of let your research be pushed in different directions and to sort of broaden your mind a bit and to get rejected here and there and realize that you aren't hitting the nail on the head and that you might need to, you know, rethink your worldview, as it were.
But it's still being the person who submits the same information again and again and again.
Yeah, and I think that having themed conferences and themed journals and all this sort of thing pushes you to, yeah, broaden your thinking, which is something you don't achieve if you never try and publish anything other than your own work as a book.
Yes. Simon, what are your thoughts?
Clarity of writing style, fundamental. Clarity of argument, absolutely fundamental. you know, we giggle, but
we giggle from pain.
Postgraduate level, it's still quite easy to come to an end of a 6,000 word paper and go, "What the hell did I just write?" Have a clear idea about what you're saying, how you're going to say it, and how it's going to be executed. And then, for the love of God, get other people to look over it as well. That usually does a good job.
Mm. Alex?
Yeah, Simon's last point is my point. Have an idea and write about it, absolutely, but the most important thing you can do for your own writing and your ability to communicate ideas to your peers is to give it to your peers, even before it goes off for publication. Give it to your fellow PhD candidates, give it to your fellow department members, give it to people that you meet at conferences, anyone who will take it, get them to read it. I think in the last podcast I listened to, Chris or David said, publish quickly and publish often, or publish lots and publish often. That's what it was. And the way to start doing that is to write and give your work to other people.
And Carol, you've got the most experience. What's your reflection?
I think I'm going to combine Simon and Sarah. I used to struggle with writing. I used to always say I wanted to be part of a research and write team, and I'd do the researching and somebody else would do the writing. But somewhere around about 10 years ago, when I was about 40, the switch in my head finally flipped, and I think most of you have learned this at a lot younger, maybe because the mentoring process is different and also because the academic climate's different. I now think the most important thing that you'll ever write is the 300-word abstract. And if you have a perfect roadmap that states exactly what you want to say and how you're going to say it, the 6,000-word paper will almost just exude from it. And so consequently, I spend a lot of time writing abstracts, and I quite like it now, and it works really well. So know what you want. That was know what you want to say. That was Sarah. Alex and Simon's was be clear.
I think these are both sage words of wisdom. Well, thank you everybody for participating this evening in our discussion. And to the viewers, or the listeners, I suppose, of this...
thank God they're not viewers.
Yeah, thank God they're not viewers. thank you for that atheist discourse, Alex. That's a refreshing end note. So in our godless universe, hopefully this has been of assistance to anybody who's considering the publication journey. Hopefully we're encouraging instead of discouraging. So ultimately, get your work out there, experiment, and it will work out for the best. We're all proof of that. So thank you.
Well, we'll make this outro brief because that was quite a long, that was quite a long recording by our standards. Just to briefly talk about next week, we have an interview with Bruno Latour.
I think we went into quite a bit of detail about it a couple of weeks ago when we were in the Hanging Bat. So we're going to have two podcasts on Bruno Latour. Basically, David very kindly agreed to, it's only every few years, really, that you get a massive name coming to your university to give a lecture relevant to your field. And we saw this coming up, the Giver Lecture Series, and thought, oh, I have to get that for a podcast, have to get Bruno Latour. Either of us would have been very intimidated with the prospect of having to familiarise ourselves with Professor Latour's work. And David stepped up to the gauntlet.
I decided to take a hit for the boys, and we talked for a little more than an hour, and we decided to split it into two halves. The first half talks about his progress up to the Gifford Lectures, and the second half talks about the Gifford Lectures themselves, and
which were on
Gaia? Facing Gaia, or Gaia. It's a sort of natural religion or the religion of nature. I think it's going to be pretty fascinating. I don't want to say too much because obviously I explain myself in quite a lot of depth as we're going through the interviews, but
yeah,
it's going to be pretty interesting to see what people make of it. I was way out of my depth. Let me put, I was outside my safety zone, I think is the way that people put it. So we'll see what happens.
We do have quite a bit of news.
We're gonna keep that news for today. I think we've done enough this week.
Yeah, and a lot of it's sort of not officially tied up with things. The RSP is at a good place right now.
We've got a lot of good stuff coming up. So we've finished our psychology series. We've had this publishing roundtable. We've got Bruno Latour next week. Then the week after that, we're into Territories New. We've got a whole new series coming up, which we'll tell you all about
later.
Find
us on Facebook, find us on Twitter, send us an email, go to our Amazon affiliates page to support us. Doesn't cost you anything, gets us quite a reasonable amount of money, really. And
most of all,
thanks for listening.